Thank you. Thank you. It's a gorgeous day, gorgeous autumn day. And thank you all for coming to our new space. There's some echoes in here, but we'll try our best. First thing I'd like to do is to once again congratulate all of you who were at the Quarter Century Club event last night. It was a wonderful event, and I'm jealous of everyone who has one of those little pins. They're really cool. And congratulations to everybody again. I enjoyed it very much, and I know that anyone who is once a member of the club is always a member of the club. So come out next year. There was a lot of food that wasn't eaten. But anyway, it was a grand celebration. I just want to center my remarks on another thing that I want to congratulate people on, and that is I want to issue publicly a very special thank you to everyone working at Hussell's Single Service Point. As I go by, I wave to people sometimes. They actually see me wave. Most of the time, they're so engaged and so busy, they don't. But I feel some really good vibes coming from there, and I just want to congratulate everybody who's working with that, but also say a very deep thank you, because there's no way that it could be working if it weren't for the people who work. Also, rest assured that I am talking to the provost about uprint issues. So, for those of you who have some big uprint issues, I'm definitely going to be doing that. So we are going to be talking, really, if you had to have a theme for this Dean's Corner meeting, it would be events of our times. We are going to be talking about the HathiTrust. I want everybody not to go to sleep with our wonderful presenters, whom I have put on the spot, because I think that not only what Hathi does for us immediately, but what it portends is hugely important. If we are in the middle of very seriously considering on this campus, I was at the Association of Research Libraries meeting last week, as were Joseph and Isabel for a little bit. We are thinking about the needs of staff in the workplace for libraries of today and tomorrow. We're very much thinking of what things like HathiTrust really were this close to having the Google scanning books, scanned books, pretty much available to us. Not quite, and we'll leave our lawyer to tell us more about that. And he's like, he's making up the law as he goes along, and he is kind of. But at least our interpretation of the law. And Joseph will be talking to you a little bit about it as well. The other thing that we talked a lot about at ARL was MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses. And if you can think of distance education on steroids, then that's what we're talking about. If you want to go back and Google it and learn a little more about it, there are two big movements. One is Coursera that came out of Stanford, and another is called edX, which came out of Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, and now the University of Texas has joined just last week. This movement is so important that the Association of Research Libraries, which normally moves in geologic time frames, met last summer with their normal board meeting, and there were so many ARL directors talking about the implications of MOOCs for libraries, that they changed their entire agenda for the October meeting. And this is a lot of what we talked about. It is something that's being talked about hugely right now on this campus. It has huge implications for librarians being embedded in a very serious way in more real terms into pedagogy. It has huge implications for licensing and delivery of content and upon what we do with our physical spaces. So it's something that I'd like everybody to think about a little bit, and we'll be keeping you up to date on that too. So we're going to talk a little bit about HATI today. We're going to have our normal updates, but we're also going to, in terms of events of our day, we're going to have brief, very brief reports, sort of like the mad minute reports, mad 5 minutes or less reports from each of our working groups, of our strategic planning working groups. So with that, I will turn it over to the Danielle and Joseph show. And Hati.
I think I'm first.
Yes, okay. Here, you're supposed to.
Did find seats back there. Okay. But there are seats in the front still. I don't know how this will do, but we'll see. So, okay. How many people have been to the place we call Hathi Trust in this room? How many don't know what I'm talking about? Anyone? That's okay to say. Well, I'm kind of starting from the beginning, and I'm assuming no one knows exactly what it is, and we'll try again. But if you've heard it before, please help me if I don't get it quite right. But I'll do my best to tell the story here. The Hathi Trust was started with ARL Libraries, Association of Research Libraries. We're one of the members of the Association of Research Libraries. It's more than a dozen libraries in Canada. It's like 15, and another 100 or so from the U.S. So we're all a part of this as research libraries. And there were a number of libraries that did the Google Books, where they came in, they scanned every book in the library, University of Michigan, University of California, a bunch of other places. And when they Google scanned all the books, those libraries got access to all those digitized books. And they did it regardless of copyright, whether it was new, old, or whatever. So they decided to start, instead of a commercial version of Google Books, we started a research library version of Google Books, and that's Hathi Trust. So it's a place where there's lots of scanned electronic books there. They aren't born digital. They're things that they took off the shelf and scanned it on a scanner and put it on the Hathi Trust. And the URL is www.hathitrust.org, if you want to go straight to Hathi Trust and look there. So when you get to Hathi Trust, you get this big screen that tells you all the different parts of it, and that's how you know that you're there. And I'll go through parts of this I've highlighted, and we'll talk about it. So one of the pieces that tells you on the front page right away is how much is in there. There's 10.5 million volumes. So last year we joined. And when we joined, I don't think it was up to 10 million yet. So this number changes all the time. It keeps getting higher and higher. And that's because they started with the University of Michigan is the place that is where Hathi Trust headquarters are. And they put every one of their books at University of Michigan here. And so other libraries that have done that also put them there. And any library that joins Hathi Trust can put their collections there. So we're putting some of our collections there, but we're not going through the whole library digitizing everything, but we benefit because of that. So there's 5.5 million book titles. So when we join Hathi Trust, the potential is that we've added 5.5 million titles to the collection. There's 274,000 serials. It even tells you in tons and miles how much stuff is in there. There's 125 miles worth of stuff. It's a huge number. It's just incredible. And there's 3.2 million volumes that are in public domain right now. Any questions about how much stuff is in there? It's really big. How much stuff do we have at McGill? Yeah, something like that. Depends on how you count. Lori's helping us trying to figure out how to count that. But in Aleph, we have 3.5 million titles, somewhere around there. So when you want to search HathiTrust, one of the boxes on that front screen was the search box. You put in your term. I just put in McGill, push find. You can choose whether you want it full view only, so things that are available full view. You can say, I don't want to see everything else. You can choose full view, or you can see everything that's in there. And when you do a search on McGill, one of the examples I found was this Roman Law Microform, a lecture delivered by Frederick William Torrance, Esquire Advocate. I did something since I'm doing this with Danielle today, related to law. It was published in 1854. It was scanned, I think, at the University of California or Harvard or someplace. And it's available full text online here at HathiTrust. But to see it, you have to go one more step, and then here's the book. It's the PDF of the book. From that, it tells you other books that are like it. It tells you how you can order it if you want to actually see the real thing. If you want to always double check, though, to see if you're actually seeing the whole thing, when you finally find a book in HathiTrust, there's a login. It's hidden up here. It's really teeny. But you push login, and then you can log in as a HathiTrust member. So we're one of the member libraries. McGill automatically comes up when you're on campus for us. If you're off campus, then you have to search for it on the menu. And then we log in with McGill first.last. And this is using this thing called Shibboleth that we've talked about sometimes. It's just a way to authenticate. And then you know that you can get in and see everything. And once you're there, it says, hi, member. And down at the bottom, it says McGill University, so that you know that you're there. You sign in once, and then you can always get things. It's not always clear when you're using HathiTrust whether you can see it or not, so I always recommend log in, and then you'll know for sure if you can actually see the full item or not. There's a couple reasons for that. I'll go into that later. And then the other thing to know about HathiTrust is when you're in HathiTrust, you can search for all the things that you can get full text for, or you can search for everything under the sun that's there. That's one way to do it. Another way that you can search is in WorldCat Local. We've turned on 2 million of the public domain items in WorldCat Local, and you can search them, and this is that same example of Roman Law in WorldCat Local. It has this view now on the brief screen, or it has the view now on the full screen. And if you click on the view now, it tells you where it's from, and it tells you, I know it's really teeny, but it says HathiTrust, so you know where it's coming from. And again, once you do that, if you haven't logged in yet, it'll ask you to log in. But we've turned those on. They're already there in WorldCat. Right now, it's just been a day or two that we've done this, turned this on, so it doesn't yet say that they're owned by McGill, but sooner or later, it'll chug along and go through all 2 million things and say that we own them at McGill. So for right now, you have to search in libraries worldwide to see all of those things. And there's something else that we turn on that's a big package like that. That's Internet Archive. It's another big book project like this. There's a million things from Internet Archive that are turned on. Some of those are in HathiTrust, and some of these are not. But there's twice as many things for HathiTrust as there are for Internet Archive. So HathiTrust was in the news last week. It was pretty exciting when we were at ARL when they announced it, because HathiTrust was taken to court by the authors. And this is the same thing that happened with Google Books. Did any of you follow the Google Books when that happened? They were in court forever. Well, HathiTrust was too. The results came back pretty excitingly, saying that this decision came out in favor of HathiTrust. And the reasons it said were digitization of books for the purposes of providing searchable index is transformative, therefore fair use under copyright law. It said the provisions of these search capabilities promote the progress of science and useful arts and thus supports the goals of the U.S. copyright policy and law. And this provision in copyright text for visually impaired students and researchers is in direct support of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's pretty clear. They came out and said what HathiTrust is doing is legal. And so we'll see what happens next. And Danielle can speak better to that than me. There's a lot of links on the HathiTrust website back on that front page that I was showing you. If you want to see some of these articles for yourself and read about it, here's another one. The court hands huge victory to university's digitization efforts. So go there and explore if you want to get some more details. But it sounds really exciting for us. It opens up a potential that maybe we don't have access just to public domain. Maybe it's everything or some slice of everything. So we're going to see what that means. So Danielle will talk more about Canadian copyright issues that we're working on, but I'll go through where we are right now. So right now when you use HathiTrust, the dates that you can get right now in the U.S. and Canada are 1923 for U.S. publications, if it was from the U.S. If it's from anywhere else, Canada included, it's 1870. And that's to go back to make sure that it's covering the most countries across the world and the most copyright acts. So, and then all dates for U.S. government documents. So anything before 1923 from the U.S. or before 1870 is available online with HathiTrust. And then U.S. government publications, there's no date restriction. It's everything that's out there. So with that, McGill and the University of Calgary are working together because we'd like to get a Canadian version of that. We think that Canadian copyright should get us up newer than that, and maybe we're even going to push it farther with this new ruling, but we'd like to do something about that and get some dates in there for Canadian government documents that we don't have around yet, because we think that that should be under fair dealing somehow. We make sure that we use Shibboleth as an access point because we're a member of HathiTrust, and we want to make sure that the people accessing this are true McGill users. So that's why you have to sign in to see what you're looking at, because that's part of the agreement. And then we're working with other partners in Canada who are on the edge of also joining this, that are interested about it, University of Ottawa, Alberta, UBC, University of Toronto. We've been talking to them about it. And we're going to present at the CARL meeting that's coming up next month, the Canadian Association of Research Libraries. So Danielle will talk more about next steps. And Amy wanted me to remind everyone that we are adding content from McGill. We want to add the things that will make it a richer database and provide research opportunities for scholars. So we're adding chapbooks because we've been doing chapbooks and we're excited about chapbooks. And if Richard was here, he could tell us lots of things about them. But that's one project that we're adding right now. And the other cool thing that we have with HathiTrust is there's a way that we can we've become a member, through HathiTrust and through Google. We can now let researchers use the data in HathiTrust, the actual books and the metadata, to do research, all sorts of data mining. So we've already had a couple professors that have come forward and talked to some librarians at Hustle about it, and they've worked with Amy. So if you have any researchers that are doing any sort of data mining or research projects involving big chunks of books that have been digitized in this collection, we can help them get that information and do exciting research projects in the humanities that way. So contact Amy if you have any questions about that. So any questions about HathiTrust? Angela.
How many members, and what's the cost for being a member?
That's a good question. On their website they tell us that there's at least more than half of the ARL members are members of HathiTrust too. If you go to that place where you sign in, all the members are there and you can look at them. They're all the research libraries. One exciting new partner is the Library of Congress. I'm glad you brought that up, yeah, because they're one of the newest members. And so everyone's really excited to see what the Library of Congress brings to that, because they've digitized a lot of stuff and they're kind of a big library. So we're excited about that. The cost is an interesting formula. The cost is one of these things that maybe sounds like a pyramid scheme, but the more people that join, the cheaper the cost. And so as more libraries join, the cost goes down because it is a trusted repository. And the more people that are sharing that cost of the trusted repository makes it cheaper. So when we first joined, they told us it was going to be about $30,000, and now it's down to about $28,000. $28,000 to have access to, right now, 3.5 million books, plus if we ever get access to the rest, is nothing. If anyone knows how much Springer cost or Elsevier or those kind of things, so that can be in the millions. This is nothing for what we spend. It's a good question. Anything else? Yes.
You said that the Corey case said that it was lawful for HathiTrust to provide these materials for visually impaired users and for indexing purposes. That the court decision covered the issue of the material being provided to non-visually impaired users as a full-text surrogate for print edition as opposed to just for indexing purposes.
Danielle.
Yes, no.
I defer to the lawyer.
Let me read that question. I will try to cover what a boring everyone is doing, but that's what the cogent facts of the case. My comment, which has nothing to do with what I'm going to say, is that there was an incredible amount of gray material in HathiTrust. The example Joseph pulled is in the. The example Joseph pulled is indeed an example of the type of gray literature one finds. And the quality of the OCR is really fantastic. But these were the comments I had on what you had to say. Are you?
Does anyone else have any other questions? If not, I'll turn it over to Danielle. This is for you. Good luck.
Thanks. Yes, thank you, Joseph. So. That goes
this
in my pocket?
Is your little clicker? Yes.
My little clicker.
And that will bring you forward.
Great, thanks. A few notes at the beginning. I mean, I look at all of you, and we've spoken together about intellectual property because you have to answer questions from users very often. And I try to give you a 24-hour turnaround time if I can't answer the question immediately. And I want to urge you to continue to come up with those questions because it enables me to actually articulate our policies and our needs a lot better. So, I mean, keep those emails and those phone calls coming, and I'm always happy to try to resolve those issues and help our users with their intellectual property problems. Those of you who heard my copyright talk of last year, remember that in our library we have three pillars of intellectual property, namely the copyback agreement, which is extremely important, the Copyright Act, which is very important as well, and various licenses. And merci beaucoup, Louis, wherever you are, for getting those licenses done in such a cost-effective manner. The first thing I want to talk about is where are we at with copyback? We were supposed to have signed a new license with copyback this summer. And I understand that every university had agreed to sign the license. But one bureaucratic detail I never told you about is that we don't actually sign the license with copyback directly. CREPUC does. So what happened is at the 11th hour, because of a bill which will drastically change copyright law in Canada, the rectors saw fit not to sign the copyback agreement, believing that a reopening of the negotiations would give us a better deal, both from a financial and a content point of view. So where we're at is, as we're speaking, probably in the Loto-Québec building behind closed doors, you got people in the back of envelopes there working things out about how many photocopies we're doing and all this sort of thing, and they hope to arrive at a deal. Copyback very nicely extended the license as it stands and will probably extend it for 1 year. So we probably have 1 year of copyback more. Now, bear in mind that with copyback, nothing digital is covered. It merely covers the world of print, namely the photocopies that we and our students do in the library, the course packs, etc., etc., etc. Just to review, the cost per FTE, we're still paying $25.50 per FTE, which is competitive with the rest of Canada for this sort of thing, and I think CREPUC is trying to get us a significantly lower amount per FTE. So that's Quebec. Let's move on to the Copyright Act. Well, those of you who remember my presentation from last year remember that the Copyright Act is in fact a bundle of rights, and I went into moral rights. I won't go into that again. You know, you all remember the Canada geese from the Eaton Center with the bows around them, and it's sort of, if you don't, speak to me afterwards. But all that to say that right now, there's a new bill which has been passed by Parliament, and this new bill actually promotes user rights, which is something that the Supreme Court spoke about roughly 8 years ago. And it's a very interesting switch from believing that our use of material is no longer an exception, but is now a right that we have as citizens to use materials. And this becomes very important as the story progresses. Because the new bill actually expands fair dealing. I mean, those of you, you know, when we talk on the phone and I say, well, the professor wants to, download half the library in WebCT, and I say, well, that's not quite fair dealing. Why doesn't the professor download a quarter of the library to WebCT? We might get away with that. You know how fair dealing is actually a pretty squishy blancmange of a concept which enables us to take copyrighted material and use it without transgressing the law. So what the new Copyright Act does now is it expands fair dealing and it recognizes educational uses explicitly. I'm sorry, this is a bit small, but if you look at the former... Is there a laser pointer in this one? Where? Well, anyway, okay. If you look at the wording, which is now before us, fair dealing for purposes of research or private study, design infringed copyright. Now we include education as a specific user right under what will be the new law. I'm sorry, I just... And now what we've all been waiting for, the famous ILL clause. So we will no longer be required to, you know, print the digital file and deliver the copy on paper. I mean, I think we've discussed that to death for a while. I believe some universities are doing this already. And also, the Copyright Act will allow the loading of digital materials for distance learning purposes, which includes WebCT. So, you know, the question you've all asked me at one point or another, the prof doesn't want a deep link. Yeah, I told the prof he or she should deep link, but they don't want a deep. They want to put up a PDF. And, well, they can't do that. Why not? Well, okay, this sort of thing. Well, now, thanks to the new Copyright Act, it is understood by people who understand that sort of thing that uploading copyrighted material in WebCT will now be legal, provided that you... How shall I say? You apply what WAG call the 30-day book burning rule, which is that you're only allowed to put the stuff into WebCT, and then you're supposed to destroy all the files after 30 days after the course is over. It's a bit arcane, but that's the way it's going to be. And that's, you know, I mean. Something else which I find very interesting is that the new law will differentiate between a commercial and non-commercial violation of copyright. Very handy if we get sued, because ours would be non-commercial uses of copyright. So that's an interesting to note. Something else that will affect Eamon more than anyone else is that the Copyright Act will implement the rights and protections of WIPO. And this will bring us in line with G8 partners in the OECD. So, Eamon, you know, people are going to ask you a lot of questions about WIPO and what does it mean, what does it stand for, you know, this sort of stuff. And what I kind of feel badly about is if we actually abide by the WIPO convention, a very, very, very nice Canadian solution to a big problem on internet called a notice and notice system will have to go by the wayside, which is... I mean, the notice and notice system is something that we use when we did our yearbooks. I don't know if Amy's here, but I mean, anyway. What happens is that if an internet service provider finds out that on your website you're transgressing copyright law, there can be an anonymous, the copyright holder can send a notice to the internet service provider, who will then tell the transgressor to bring it down. So this notice-to-notice system has worked very effectively, but I am told that if we abide by the WIPO convention, we won't be able to do that anymore. But that's just, I mean, that won't affect us very, very much. So, something else people, I mean, it won't affect us, but something that people are very sort of angry about is the new law will prohibit the circumventing of digital locks. So you know how for every ebook there's a different license? For every ebook there's a different amount of pages you can download or pages you can print or whatever. Well, that's the way it's got to be. And there's no way we can actually break into those digital locks. And if we do, I mean, the fines are astronomical, even if we are doing it for a non-commercial purpose. Okay, now when will all this come about? Well, June 29th, the new bill was given royal assent. And when I tried to find out what, you know, well, yeah, but when is it going to become the law, I was told que c'était dans le processus de décret. So that means we're waiting, I mean, translated into normal language, we're waiting for the Privy Council to actually enact the law, and it could happen anytime now. So I talked about three pillars earlier. I talked about the licenses, the Copybank Agreement, the Copyright Act. Well, I don't think HathiTrust is really a license. Joseph described what HathiTrust was all about. But HathiTrust is a very special license. And I would say it's actually a fourth pillar of copyright, because we're accessing material in HathiTrust, not paying for it on a per datum basis, the way we pay for all of our other licenses, but we access it as citizens, because it's our right to access that material. And the fee Joseph talked about is actually an administrative fee, but we don't pay for the data itself, which I believe is a fundamental sea change in the way we are dealing with online information. As Joseph said, HathiTrust allows for what they call non-consumptive research. Well, that's a nice term. You know, what this means is you can actually do some bibliographical analyses into copyrighted material, and it's okay. In other words, that entire corpus of 10,200,082 books and a gazillion miles of periodicals is available to you with algorithms that actually work in order to mine these data and do some interesting research in digital humanities. And a lot of our colleagues in the US are doing this already. Now, Joseph touched about that, but that famous trial, Authors Guild versus HathiTrust last year, well, you know, the elephant triumphant. When I went to the HathiTrust Constitutional Convention, I said, well, it's a great thing, but boy, what a dumb, I mean, why did they call it that? Well, then, you know, when you think about it, you know, it's actually a Kipling character, and in the Kipling story, it's very serious. In the Walt Disney movie, it's not, but anyway. The triumph at the court opens a lot of possibilities. And there are some big differences between this suit and the trial of Authors Guild versus Google. Because when there was, when the authors or the copyright holders were seeing, were suing Google over these data files, they were seeking damages. Whereas what they were seeking as HathiTrust is actually the destruction of the files. They were seeking an injunction to actually get rid of all this thing, and they lost, and lost badly. Had they won, scanning would have become an infringement. The existing data files would have been impounded or destroyed. Public domain scans that are said to be made in limbo, and it would have had a chilling effect on scanning projects all over the Western world. But actually, the HathiTrust made the concept of fair dealing move forward for all of us. which is why it's such an important development. And what Hathi's lawyers managed to prove was that there was no genuine issue of material fact about fair use. And something else that satisfied me, and again I go back to those phone calls and emails that we have, is that you know how very often we talked about copyright, we talk about 20% or the 40% of a chapter of 7 pages, and then the guy read in the copy back thing that it was like he could photocopy half the book and this sort of thing. It's clear that what Hathi was doing is photocopy an entire book. So there was no more 20% of the 80% of the chapter or this sort of thing. And this was said to be fair use in the U.S. So even if a lot of people talk about hard numbers or percentage guidelines, those were totally cast aside. And to me, that's a great victory for us. The thing about print, the whole question of print disabilities, which Joseph raised, is actually quite interesting, because for me it was a real no-brainer that, you know, people with print disabilities could use the HathiTrust, but it isn't. Apparently, and especially during those WIPO treaty negotiations, I talked about the WIPO agreement before, the World Intellectual Property Organization was just trying to homogenize copyright law throughout the Western world. They were actually fighting against opening digital files for people who have print disabilities. So I'm very happy to see an opinion affirming the ability of an entity to provide access. So the court also found that HathiTrust's use is non-commercial, which is reassuring. The association with Google wasn't deemed to be commercial. And when the publishers put forward the claim that every copy made by Hathi, all the 10 million, was a lost sale, was kind of dismissed outright by the courts as a bit silly. And that the claim that Hathi was an immense security risk was not supported by any factual evidence. So it is a victory for libraries and open access, especially during Open Access Week. And it is a very big turning point, because it will certainly affect us. Mark, could you repeat your question?
Yes. could you repeat your question?
Yeah.
The court decision said that there were two aspects of HathiTrust that made this material legitimate. The first was providing access to visually impaired users.
Yeah.
The other legitimate use was the fact that it was serving an indexing function.
Yeah.
What I was wondering is, that seems to leave out a third possibility, which is if you're a non-visually impaired user and you were using HathiTrust not as an indexing tool, but as a substitute for the full text of a print edition.
Yeah.
Did the court decision cover that permutation?
Okay, the question is, it's fine to do non-consumptive research. The court says so explicitly. It's fine to provide data files to print impaired people, the court says so explicitly. But can we brazenly take a book that's been digitized, a Google file from, say, 2002, and just make those available to the public? We're not there yet. But I do believe that the sympathy with which the judge kind of hinted at that sort of thing means that we might be there quite soon. Also, the fact that he broadened the notion of fair use to do away with percentages or numerical interpretation of what fair use is means that this actually may happen. What we're working on is, Joseph talked about a kind of a Canadian position articulated by Calgary and McGill, and I understand that position to be that we feel that we could make a chapter of a book available to users who are not print impaired, who are not doing non-consumptive research. Now, I went on a lot, and I talked about CopyBeck, and I talked about the new Copyright Act, and I talked about HathiTrust. And do you have any questions or comments now?
Yeah.
about all this. Eamon.
Well, this is a U.S. court case, so what effect would it have here? Like, I mean, I guess there wouldn't be any really legally, but what if an author's guild were to try this internationally? Because they come to, and try this under Canadian copyright to prevent us accessing this data. Is that something that's possible?
Okay. It's a very, very, very pertinent question. What this decision is means to us is that it's extremely persuasive. And the same, remember how I talked about how the Supreme Court went from characterizing fair dealing in Canada from being an exception to being a user right? That was done through the incorporation of American doctrine because Americans have always had a broader interpretation of what, how far we can use copyrighted materials for various legitimate purposes. So I see it as having a great impact, although as from your question, I understand that you understand that it's not binding on Canadian courts. Do you have a question on the question, or because that's sort of...
I guess kind of what I was getting at is, let's say, I mean, obviously this is, you know, this was ruling based on U.S. Copyright Act, copyright law, with the new Copyright Act that we have here, do those changes make it probable that a similar decision or a similar would be made here under the same circumstances?
Right, well that's sort of a, one can't predict what will happen. I mean, the Supreme Court, of course, has gone zigzag on copyright. I mean, they've made a lot of judgments that were pro-open, and then they closed them down a bit. So it's hard to say, but as I understand, I think that there's a momentum which is reflected in the new way fair dealing is defined, which probably, I would venture to say, means that the Supreme Court might go in that direction. But that's only my guess. Laurie?
Given the new way that fair dealing is defined in the assumed to be new copyright law in Canada, why would any university sign a copyback agreement, or is that going to change?
Well, that again is a it's a fair comment, and in English Canada, there's many universities who are going ahead and not signing a license with the English Canadian equivalent of copyback. For the very reason that you mentioned, is because they think that it can get along without the license. Now, does that make sense? The saving $8 million in licensing and getting a $10 million lawsuit, is that good, is that good mathematics? I don't know. But there are certainly a lot of people agree with what you're saying, which is why we don't have a copyback license right now. And they're and they've reopened it. We're still paying the last one because we don't want to be in total, because then we would be in total illegality. But what may happen is that the FTE cost of copyback may go down radically. That's what might be the outcome of all this. Yeah. Do you have a follow-up question on your comment? Because all that stuff is...
The new copyright law in Canada, does it still protect, is the period of protection of work still the life of the author plus 50 years?
It still is, yeah.
Yes. So in other words, if we wanted to digitize a book locally from our collection, one would have to take that into account.
Right.
Right, okay. And if we were to access a book in HathiTrust, which was the life of the author plus 49 years or 48 years, okay, that they had digitized because perhaps the American law was different, then would the act of our, and should we be able to access it in HathiTrust because they opened it up, would the act of our accessing such a work, which is still protected in Canada, be a violation, a non-profit violation?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. In that,
HathiTrust makes available stuff that was published in the 60s and 70s, and the authors are very much alive or just recently dead.
Well, HathiTrust is not doing that.
No, I know. But
no, they're not doing that. Okay. What they're doing is they're only making available what's in the public domain right now.
Right.
So, but say that they would be, would there be, well, you know, you would have to, it's called, but I mean, there's people in universities. You have people with full-time jobs, and they're called risk assessors, you know? So you would go see the copyright risk assessor, and a copyright risk assessor would decide if this is a wise course of action or not, would be to transgress the Copyright Act ostentatiously in that fashion.
Basically, copyright is still
absolutely, yeah. And that's, but with a widening of fair dealing in Canada, with an American judge stating that fair use in the U.S. no longer is a question of percentages or fractions of this sort of thing, but can be a whole work. How long this absolute rule will last is something neither you nor I can guess. You know, I mean, it might, you know, because you see, if you take fair dealing, take the user right for education, take the winds that are blowing, you know, take the direction the winds are blowing, and it might be less cut and dry than it was, say, a year ago. Sure.
Do you want to talk about what we were thinking about before we did the results of the suit, don't you? Because we wanted to go ahead with something like that,
the 1908. Yeah, we want to go ahead and do that. Yeah, what we were thinking is looking at the 50 years and logically interpreting the law as it is and the law as it will be and education use and all that. Joseph and I were thinking of having the year 1900 as the year of the birth of the author as a good cutoff point for making materials available for works published in Canada. You know, but we're still we're still negotiating that, and, you know, we're trying to arrive at a made in Canada policy for HathiTrust, which is
Canadian government document policy too.
Yeah, well, that's a Canadian government policy. That's kind of a funny one. In the U.S., there's no copyright on government documents because the logic is they belong to everyone. In Canada, we have Crown copyright. In other words, they belong to the Crown. The thing is, Crown copyright is a bit like Crown land, you know? I mean, Crown land, you equate that with, you know, land we all own, you know? But I mean, it would be very hard for us to explain to our colleagues in the U.S. that, yes, there is copyright in government documents, but there isn't really copyright in government documents. And this is going to be quite a challenge for us, but I think we might be able to open the government documents to.
At least pick a year and say, thank you for this year, we should have free access to it.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, in terms of our collaboration to follow up on what you was talking about, are you thinking of any cutoff points for archival records, like institutional records of McGill? I mean, I've gone through, for example, we had a case where someone asked for records from the 1950s and wanted to have copyright, see if they had copyright in order to publish them. It was records dealing with rare manuscripts that McGill was purchasing at Sea Scrolls, which McGill purchased and never got. But there was a controversy about it, which is in the administrative records of the university.
I see.
And in terms of copyright, you could go through those administrative records, and the copyright of records written by McGill people belong to the university. So we give that to the research and we could use those. But for all the other ones, that copyright belonged to the authors. The incoming correspondence belongs to the authors who wrote it, and not to the university.
Okay, I wish I could repeat the question, but you kind of lost me at one point. Archives are very, very complex, are a very complex subject, because not only do you have copyright itself, but you also have the impact of la loi d'accès sur... sur les renseignements personnels, which I believe is more germane to archival problems. I mean, I would characterized that law as being, instead of having three things, you guys have one. And that's la loi sur le renseignement personnel. What I believe also, and I believe this, and I hope my colleague Lynn Thibault would believe this as well, and I will check with her, is that once you give your letters and your archive to McGill, unless you've explicitly stated it's a dark archive, which is like a new word. I mean, I learned that, a dark archive. I mean, it sounds like Indiana Jones, you know, but it doesn't sound like a dark archive to me. There is what I would call an implicit license to make it available, unless you're transgressing la loi sur le renseignement personnel. Are there nominative information there? Are they, you know, they, I mean, you're probably familiar, more familiar with the criteria of la loi than I am about that. But in answer to your question, we don't have a, Joseph and I don't have a policy on archives just yet.
No, the things that we're looking at adding would be things that we were sure that were.
Yeah, exactly.
And we wouldn't cause any problems. Yeah. So we have so many other things to add first.
Right.
I mean, certainly from the archive perspective, we really need to deal, we deal with these things in the deed of gift. So the owner,
right.
if it's not out there,
right.
the author or the donor deals with it explicitly, and there will be a clause as to how we give access and the extent of intellectual property that's given. I think the one thing, one comment I just want to make in terms of hearing you mm-hmm. and the kind of subjectivity of what you have, the way that you've expressed it from the librarian's perspective, it's a kind of us and them we're trying to, and from the archivist's perspective, we're also representing in a way the authors, because as we acquire authors' materials, we also have to manage it in such a way that they're comfortable donating it to us, knowing that we're going to manage it in a way that encourages
that is responsible. That is responsible.
That is responsible.
Okay. Now, I believe a
Less of an us and them, that the subjectivity tends to
come on, there's no us and them. I mean, the thing is that we assume that if McGill University curates something, I mean, we're not a Swiss bank vault, you know? I mean, we're there to make it available to the public, or at least that's my understanding of our mandate. But that's neither here nor there. Maybe we could discuss this at the next Dean's Corner.
Right.
Who's next? You are. You are?
Yeah, I just real quickly.
Sure. Oh, sorry. Can I finish my thing?
Yeah.
Sorry, Colleen.
Okay.
If you want, the slides are going to be posted. If you want to know about a new Copyright Act, there's an excellent legislative summary done by our colleagues in Ottawa called Bill C-11, an act to amend the Copyright Act, everything you want to know and more. There's also a great satirical piece done by law students called Crack the Course Pack. They're my students. I'm very proud of them. Check it out. Also, the URL above is for the summary. And thank you very, very much.
Okay, I am going to see how we... Aw. Yeah. Okay, the working group updates. I just want to say thank you very much to Danielle and to Joseph. Mucking through all of this ambiguity is not easy, and I was impressed with how they managed to communicate very quickly some very difficult issues that they've been working on at least since I've been here. So it is a work in progress, all of these changes, but suddenly these things that we've been worrying about for a long time are moving in really substantive ways, and I think we're seeing a tipping point. This could be a watershed moment, and it has gigantic implications for everything that we do, as you can see if you just have a glass of wine and talk with one another a little bit about what it might mean to facilities, what it might mean to staffing, what it might mean to our collections, what it might mean to what we buy and how we serve users. Huge, absolutely huge. So this is, we don't have a lot of time to get through these things, so I will just ask people to be crisp and to the point. So information literacy, and if y'all can just introduce the next people as you leave and pass this off, then that will keep me from hopping up and down. Just click to the next one. You'll know who it is. Hop up and down. Take care of yourself so that we don't waste my time y'all's time with my hopping up and down like a jack-in-the-box. So, Carol.
I will be really brief. Be really, really brief. So neither Brian nor April can attend today's Dean's Corner because of teaching conflicts. So they delegate me as the leader of the working group to deliver this really brief report. So the Information Literacy Working Group has reached a point where April and Brian, as co-author, are assembling the initial draft of the report based on the contribution of the members of the working group. So you need to know that we divide the large team that we were into four different subcommittee or subgroup. We have a group on the goals and objectives, another group on the current practice at McGill, another group to see best practices internationally, and the fourth subgroup was about the report structure and outreach. So the working group plans to pass this draft by the appropriate administrative authority, so it means the dean, and eventually also the dean's cabinet, to ensure that we are on track with expectations. Then the member of the working group will revise, elaborate, review, edit, re-edit the report for a final report. Of course, the working group plans also to organize open sessions for all of you and all of us before the end of the year for the library staff to discuss and contribute to the draft report before the final version will be submitted to the dean. The working group would like to thank, of course, all of you who participated in the current information literacy practices survey, and we look forward to continuing the dialogue as we define the vision of information literacy at McGill. I'm just wondering if the members of this working group would like to add something else to this report? No? So, do you have any questions? So, I will turn over my colleague, Anais. Yes! Oh, my duty.
Thank you. So I'm reporting for Megan and Natalie, who couldn't make it today. It's been a while since the entire collection stewardship working group met together, but we've all been busy, and each subgroup has been working on its own, and we're actually making progress. Group one, which is looking into space, has finished collecting shelving and shelf occupancy data from all branches, even though renovations and different moves of parts of collections have made it quite difficult. But, well, the data we have is good for now, and it will need to be updated when the renovations and the moves are complete. The data has been compiled and turned over to Laurie Cloda, who is currently working on producing a report, I guess, about shelf occupancy at McGill Libraries. As expected, the data shows a tremendous lack of space in almost all branches. So this will provide evidence, I guess, to support the need to build a storage facility or to find a solution. This leads to group two. Group two was looking into storage at other universities and is currently working on their report recommending three different storage options. The expected date of completion for the report is fall 2012, I believe. Group three was looking into legacy and heritage collections. The recent meetings of group three focused only on action required for Redpath basement following the flooding. So the group came up with a short-term steps for materials located in the space, including recommendations of moving the material that needed to be protected. They are now returning to work on a summary report of discovery phase discussions, and the summary report on legacy and heritage collections should be completed for November 1st. The last group, group four, was looking in collection policies at other universities, has completed the report in June. And this report is accessible on the U Drive under U Common Committee's Collection Stewardship Group 4, if you want to have a look at it. And that's all for me. Oh, really? I'm just relying on what Matt gave me, so okay.
Okay, so hi, I'm Genevieve Gore, and Julie Jones couldn't be here because she's teaching my research. And we thought we would start our part by reminding people to recycle as much as possible because we're the sustainability committee, so we want to promote recycling. We realize recycling is very confusing here. We're working on that too. So just to give you a tip for today, recycling is actually in two streams. There's one stream for paper and cardboard, so those blue bins are usually for that, and then a separate stream for glass, metal, and plastic. So they have to be kept separate. It's best to rinse stuff if it's really dirty, if it's dirty, to empty out containers of liquids and so forth. Because if you contaminate, cross-contaminate the recycling may just go out into the trash. So we're trying to avoid that. We're trying to increase our recycling here. So just remember, please recycle, please rinse, and no plastic, number six. So we've been pretty busy. We participated in the Sustainability Fair, the McGill Sustainability Fair. And that's basically where you sort of have a dog and pony show to say what you've been up to. It was more like a baby calf show because the Mac people had a baby calf there that really sort of took a lot of the attention, but that was okay. We had a good presence. We were giving out popcorn. That wasn't really our plan, but we did it anyway. And we were trying to promote the library as the go-to place for authoritative information to make evidence-informed sustainability decisions, and not just for faculty and students, but also for staff. So that was our angle there. And we also created a sustainability guide, which is online. We're also working hard on waste and recycling. It's a bit of a saga. It's ongoing. Signage is also a big problem. Many branches have received those large three-section bins in public areas. People didn't know where they came from. There was a lot of confusion. We're still a bit confused. The color was wrong. We're waiting, basically, to get bins that are the right color, so don't worry too much about the color. But that we're following up on. We're also obviously going to try to make signage less confusing because right now we think that there are too many signs and it's a bit hard to follow what's going on and where you're supposed to put stuff. The other problem is that we obviously have to deal with custodial staff and that kind of issue when making decisions on recycling. So all of that makes it a bit more complicated than we'd like it to be. We're also looking, just as a warning, at moving away from those big metal waste bins that we have at our desks, which are really heavy for custodial staff to move. So we'd like to move toward a blue bin, a big blue recycling bin, with a little plastic waste bin attached to it, because those are kind of, you know, to discourage also throwing things that shouldn't go into the trash, and also making recycling easier for the plastic, metal, and glass stream. We've also developed a draft of a green meetings checklist, which you can consult on the U Drive in the committee sustainability folder. And we've been working on printing issues, and there was another note that we wanted to make. Please don't reuse if you have paper on which you've printed on one side. It's best not to use that in the printer, the printers or the devices to print on the other. It's a great idea in terms of sustainability, but unfortunately it can create jams because the dry ink can flake off and mess it up that way. The other issue is Internet Explorer overcharges some people, and they've been switching to single-sided printing. So if you want to discourage people from switching to single-sided printing, encourage them to use Google Chrome or Firefox. And also, please send us any feedback or comments you have, because we'd really like to hear from you. So for example, if anything I said offends you or you think is a terrible idea, please feel free to get in touch. And I'll move it on to the next person. Christine Oliver for RDA.
This goes on me. I hope so, too. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so this is going to be very short because right now our focus is very much on ourselves in collection services. But one of the interesting things, when this working group started, you know, the standard was out there, but there's a lot of different ways in which you can apply the standard because there's a lot of options and it's made for broader than just the library community. And so at the very beginning, sort of like the library community was sort of sitting back and sort of kind of scratching their head and thinking about how they were going to do this and, you know, how we were going to have a sort of a library application profile. And what's been interesting is that as we go along and work on our own, you know, training and preparing ourselves, we're also seeing an incredible amount of activity that's happening out in the community in terms of getting ready. So, of course, especially in a library world where we share so much, it's very much for us to be in step with what's happening throughout North America. So a lot of the stuff that we do in the working group is also pulling in information from outside in the community and making sure that we're going to be in step with it as well. So right now, as I said, our focus is on training ourselves, and we're going to do training in two-step. We're going to try the guinea pig method. We're going to have a core group that will go first, and we'll test training materials on them, see what we learn, and then do it for the rest of collection services, and then also do it for all the library as well. And during this process, we've also identified two opportunities. One of the advantages of trying this guinea pig method is by having our core group, it means we also expand the number of voices who can speak about RDA here at McGill. And the other thing that has happened, which was Joseph's dialogue with Concordia, with Cynthia, and I've forgotten her last name. Yeah, Holt at Concordia, was the idea of working together. And so we are we're working on Concordia with on training. We're attending some webinars together, and we're also planning at least a two-day workshop for collection services staff that will be both McGill and Concordia, and we're also thinking of our CREPUC, our other CREPUC partner who's Anglophone, Bishops, and they probably don't have the resources, so we're going to try to also coordinate so that they can come in with us. So this is a great opportunity also to be out there in the community. So that's it, unless you have questions.
Okay, it's space planning, but it's really McLennan Redpath space planning, just to make that clear. So what we did this summer, we closed our online and print survey. We did an online and print survey asking students, you know, what's important to you, what matters about the McLennan Redpath space. We also had a whiteboard where they could sort of free-form write lots of comments. Then they did have lots of comments, which is great. We closed that in, I think, late July, early August, and sort of built a report off of that. The main concerns and things students seem to want are more quiet space, so sort of this return to wanting the quiet, steady space of a library, more comfortable seating, that was really important, and that'll come up in our sort of second area we're doing now, outlets, restrooms came up a lot, but also, natural light, color. So these are sort of the things that matter that were sort of the top five concerns. And so we made a report based on the student comments from that, and that's on the Common Drive Committee's McLennan Redpath if you want to view it. So now we're sort of in the second phase, which is as you came up today, you may have noticed where the old loans desk used to be. It's a completely different space, full of students. So coming up shortly, we're going to be getting kind of a furniture lab going in that space. So the space planning committee is going to be looking at, you know, what works, what doesn't, what do students like. We're going to be working on a space assessment. So as opposed to just asking students what they want, actually getting a sense of what they're already doing, because they might say what they want, but then they do something differently. So we're working with Lori to try to figure out the best way to assess that and evaluate that and go forward from there. So I think that's it. Next person. Oh, wrong way. I'm going all the wrong way. Here we go. Single service.
One thing on that new space,
has 4 seats, the other has 6, I think. So.
Okay, single service group. Our group met throughout the summer primarily to collaborate and share training materials. And we did this on the U Drive, and basically groups that created materials put them there, and then other branches could borrow from the materials and adapt them as needed. And it turned out to be a really good thing because we didn't end up with a one-size-fits-all approach, but we also didn't have everybody recreating the wheel every time. And so, for example, at Hustle, we used Schulich's Module 4 for technology, and I know in some of the other branches they took 4 modules and made them into one. And so people got to have something that worked for them, but we still had a little bit of consistency among the branches as well, which was nice and maybe a nice model for future projects. We also spent a bit of time exploring what communications were needed, both externally and internally, about single service points, and we still have a few things to work on there. And at our last meeting, we're pretty excited that we started to talk about how and when to wrap up our group. And to that end, we have some recommendations that we're ready to bring forward to the Dean's Cabinet and then to the branch managers, and we'll be doing that really shortly. That's our group.
That went by really, really quickly. So I just wanted to give you a brief update on the Reserves Enhancements Working Group. Dawn and I are the co-chairs, and Diane is our acting director or resource person. Dawn couldn't be here today because she's at the Access Conference. And actually, our group submitted the final report to the dean and her cabinet last week. We had a few goals, but one of our goals was to determine the best system, for example, Aleph, WorldCat, or Desire to Learn, in which to link to our print and electronic course reserve materials. And the group's key recommendation is that links to electronic reserve material be posted in McGill University's course management system. So my courses, you've probably also heard it called Desire to Learn or D2L. The print-only reserve material should continue to be made available in the Aleph course reserve module. I'm just going to flip the page. The group selected Desire to Learn as a system for linking to our e-reserve material, since students are already accessing this resource on a frequent basis. They're in there every single day, whether it's to look at their lecture notes, whether it's to look at grades, to group discussions, they're already in there. So that's why we thought that should be the best place to link to electronic course material. Our group also recommended that library staff should automatically stop creating links to all course pack material, but rather that this service should be offered to instructors who request it. Links to electronic course material can be inserted in a Word document, usually a course syllabus, or it can also be linked directly in Desire to Learn. You can also choose to teach faculty how to make the persistent links themselves. Members of our group, and this is a part that I was excited about the whole process, but I liked meeting with other members of the group with Content and Collaboration Solutions, which is actually a subgroup of our IT department, and we met with them to try and link to the library's services and resources in Desire to Learn, in the course management system. And as a result of the meetings that we had with them, there were already some changes that were introduced in the course management system this fall semester that affected the library. One of the changes was that now on the homepage of the course management system, you actually have a link to the library. I'm like, yes, that was on the top left-hand side. We also had as well, there was a role that was created called the librarian's role in Desire to Learn. And what the librarian's role is that it permits What the instructor does is he assigns a library staff person a librarian role just by entering in your email address in Desire to Learn. And with this librarian's role, you can go in and create links to electronic course reserve materials, for example. You can also create links, if you wanted to things that we have in print in the Aleph catalog as well. Changes to Desire to Learn that affected the library were actually emailed. An email went out mid-September to all library staff explaining what these changes were. On behalf of the Reserves Enhancements Working Group, I also organized training sessions for all staff during the summer on Desire to Learn. If you weren't able to attend, just let me know and I'll set up additional training sessions. There's a copy of our report on the U Common Drive if you want to read it or you want some more information. It's in U Common Committees, and there's a folder called Reserves Committee in there. It's under Reports. Any questions or comments? It was an email about the changes in Desire to Learn. The email was sent in mid-September, and it talked about changes in Desire to Learn that affected the library.
Could we resend that?
I could resend it again. It talked about the librarian's role that I just described. It also talked about the link to the library on the Desire to Learn homepage, and there was another change as well, but I'll send the... Yeah, we'll put it on the U Drive, but the last change was also, now there's a widget that an instructor could put in Desire to Learn, and that widget actually does a search in the catalog automatically for that course. So that if there's any printed materials put on reserve, it will pull up the search results in the classic catalog. So those were the three changes. Thank you. Next.
Close to my mouth here. Okay, I have a very short report from the Document Delivery Working Group. The good news is we've received the document delivery bags. This is the large size. They're vinyl. They're modeled on the Crepuc ILL bags. They're sturdy, and we think they'll work well. And on top of that, we are barcoding them. So when we send material to professors, if they hoard the bags and return the books other ways, we'll know who has a supply of our bags. The other good news is that Jane has managed to get the new test ruckus working in Aleph 21. The bad news is she hasn't had time to develop and test the document delivery material. When she does, and when it works, hopefully sometime next month, then the Borrowing Advisory Committee has to write procedures, procedures for staff, web page information, Aleph health pages, working on the Aleph request forms, announcements, a disclaimer about copyright limitations, responsibilities, and an article for the library staff blog. So there's a fair bit of work yet to be accomplished. And more bad news, I had a bombshell email from my co-chair at the beginning of the week saying that when it came time to retire from McGill, she always wanted to do it quietly and not have a fuss made. So I am now no longer a co-chair. Deanna Cowan has retired. She was most helpful on the committee, so I want to publicly thank her. And until and unless the dean appoints a new co-chair, I seem to become a chair. Thanks. So the next...
Thank you. So the HR update will be short and sweet, just like me. Oh. I'm in front of the TV, so. Genevieve, paperless? So this month of October.
Oh, okay.
So this month of October, we closed the Osler search. So we made an offer to Anna Dysart, and Anna will be joining the Osler staff in the month of November, November 1st. We sent also an internal posting to the 111 Munaca staff member concerning the two vacant positions in collection services, specialized catalog editor, and also the document technician with Valerie Maiman. Well, it's collection services. Okay, well, collection services is your home, and you have a little room called Interlibrary Loans. I think everybody knows. Okay. So, concerning rare books, unfortunately, we were not able to find a candidate that was meeting all our expectations. So right now, we just put this one on hold, and we'll revisit. It's important right now, at the time we are now, and I'm not talking about any budget constraint, but where the library is moving forward, that we make sure that we hire people that have the skill set that will bring us forward now that we're at this crossroad. As mentioned by the dean in her introduction, yesterday was the 44th Quarter Century Club Gala. Exceptionally, last night we had two cohorts, the 2011 cohorts and the 2012 cohorts. So, and 11 of our colleagues, we welcome 11 of our colleagues in that famous club for 2011, and here are the names for 2012. It was a wonderful evening. Very prestigious. It's very dear to the principal's heart and all the McGill community. That's it for HR update.
Great. I'll be short but tall.
You'll be sweet and tall. That's short and tall.
Good. I'll only be a few moments because I'm really just updating you on showing you pictures of the progress we've been making with facilities. So a picture is worth a thousand words. Jessica mentioned the Redpath group study area. There are 50 open seats. The two group study rooms are now bookable, and when our furniture arrives on November 1st, it will replace the temporary furniture that's currently in the space. But no sooner were the tables and chairs put in than students just flocked to it. So it's being well received. One of the group study rooms, new furniture will be coming, and do encourage people to book. Now, the McLennan Library Building third floor reno, really progressing. Students are already up there. We still have, the electricity has gone into the tables. We'll be putting the whiteboards up, and we will be fully launched, I would say within the week. Would that be true? Great. There are, and I wrote it on my hand, 337 seats up there in a variety of formats. but it's a mix. It's a wonderful mix of seating. The electrified tables, there are different zones with different colors, and people will find a spot that's right for them. We've got the wavy tables that Dean Cook really wanted to see in there. They're wavy and they're wonderful. We have the bookable grad study tables, which will be, I'm looking over at Joyce, they'll be bookable soon. And then, of course, movable non-electrified tables in a different color. So it's starting to really shape up. The law library, I just wanted to mention, there has been some wonderful work happening up there, mainly with lighting upgrades. The graduate study room has been launched, and you can really, if you go up and visit the lobby, it really is beautiful now and opened up for our users. So with the great seating, second floor all new and with enhanced lighting. There's a new study area on the fourth floor in the law library coming soon. Shelves were taken down and study spaces added. I think this picture speaks for itself. The chair, I do have a bet going with Colleen on whether or not it will be finished before the snow flies. I'm still standing by my bet. But it is progressing, and there will be a lovely, lovely seating area outside of the main doorway. And you can see the dirt going in, and there'll be plants, and it'll be gorgeous, and it won't look like this. The Schulich roof replacement, I think it's going to be spectacular with all the heritage roofing materials, bronze going up, and it will just be a wonderful visual. And hopefully it won't.
Thank you all. We have managed to get through an enormous amount of content in an hour and a half. I was really worried that we were going to be able to do it. I'm impressed with with the work of all the working groups, particularly the one that's done. that done is good. Some of them are movable feasts, I'm afraid. They're not likely to get done in my lifetime, like collection stewardship. Although they have gotten some milestones done that are really important. FYI, the data that I got from Lori and from Anais on our collection capacity shows that we're, if you average it out, we're probably 103% occupied. It's just ridiculous. It's not uniform, certainly, but it's beyond the pale. And those are things, of course, that's my job to communicate to university administrators. So with that, I really did want to say thank you to everybody who gave reports today. They did it in an expeditious way with a lot of content, and everyone here was paying attention for an hour and a half, which is amazing. So it was meaningful. We are living in very interesting times, and it is fall. But I will entertain any questions really quickly from near or far on anything. Okay? Okay, thank you all very much.